This is Clayton for The Cash Flow Show in association with Podcast Radio Business. We're joined by Anthony Hamer Hodges, principal at the London College of Contemporary Music. And we're here to discuss why independent artists are taking over the Brits. Thank you for joining us, Anthony.
Hi, Clayton. Great to be on.
You're most welcome, sir. Please tell me more about your role at the London College of Contemporary Music.
Yeah, no, so I am the principal of the college, and we are teaching the next generation of music performers, music producers, and music business execs. So it's really inspiring for me to channel my experience working in the business side of the industry in to help the next generation come through.
So we mentioned at the top of this report, independent artists. Can you give your definition of what you think an independent artist is?
Well, the traditional definition from a sort of economic perspective is the independent sector are everyone releasing music that's not associated with the big international conglomerates, the three big music companies, Universal, Sony and Warner. They dominate the market, or traditionally they have dominated the market. And everyone who chooses to go it alone obviously has to work a bit harder. They don't have the multi-million pound budgets for international release. But the music can be more authentic and have a longevity as a result.
But independent artists are not a new phenomenon. Even going back as far as the 50s, Elvis Presley started off as an independent artist on Sun Records.
Well, I think, you know, if you do follow the history, every exciting scene, every exciting genre, even the biggest record labels now that are part of the major conglomerates, they all started out as independent labels. So, you know, if you think about Richard Branson and Virgin Music and the acts from the 80s that he signed, Culture Club and all the rest of it at the time, they were independent music. That was a really exciting, challenging, spiky independent label. Now it's one of the big major labels as part of the Universal Group, which is the biggest of them all.
Big news at the weekend in relation to singer-songwriter Ray. Incredible success. I think it was 7 Brit nominations and a record-breaking 6 wins. Tell us about the buzz that's created.
Yeah, I think it's incredible. I mean, I feel like maybe her team should have briefed her better. She seemed totally surprised and perplexed in a lovely, authentic way by the recognition at the weekend. She was nominated for 7 awards. I think she probably could have assumed she'd win some of them, but she won 6 out of the 7, which beat the previous record. No one had ever won more than 4 Brits in one evening before. And the Brits, remember, is organized by the BPI, which is a largely major label-backed organization. And historically, it's quite rare for independent artists to do well. I think Adele, signed to XL Recordings, has obviously been one exception. I was a big fan of the band called the KLF growing up. And for a long time, KLF Communications was one of the only truly independent labels that had been recognized at the Brits. But now, the biggest ever winner in one night at the Brits is an independent artist. And her story is incredible.
And I'm going to come back to her story in a moment. What I find fascinating is, to be totally honest, I'm a grown man. If I won 6 Brits, I'd be crying too.
Well, I think I was crying watching it. You know, it's hard not to be taken along in the genuine emotion of that and her and the impact on her, because she has had such a hard journey to get there.
Indeed. And about that journey, she originally was on Polydor Records for years, for something like 6 or 7 years, if my sources brief me correctly. And it appears to have all come to a head in the last couple of years, because she appeared to have made a very frustrated social media post where she basically sort of said, I've been banging away at this for ages. I've done everything that you've asked me to do and you won't let me release an album. There are 2 things here. Obviously, Polydor Records did release her from her contract, allowing her to become this independent artist. The first question is, where did Polydor Records go wrong? And 2, why do you think that there are many people who fight to get released from their contract but never make it? And why was she so special?
I mean, there's so many layers to unpack there. I think if you go to the real heart of entertainment and the heart of media and the heart of the record industry, you'll find an obsession with newness. So anything new is more exciting than anything known. So the entire engine of A&R, which is like the research and distribution side of the record industry, they're trying to find new artists all the time. What's the most exciting new artist? Who can they sign? Who can they beat their rivals who are trying to sign the freshest, newest talent? And Ray was snapped up as one of those fresh young talents, age 15, but that was 10 years ago and did very well. In fact, I think if there's one criticism of her Six Brits the Weekend, it's questionable whether she should have been nominated in the best new artist category, because she has been doing the rounds for that long, for 10 years. I was Googling, looking for an image for her the weekend associated with the Brit Awards, and I found pictures of her attending the Brits since 2017. So it's been a long time coming for her. And she had several big hits as a songwriter and as a featured vocalist. So she had success. But she was an artist. And that's, as she said on the podium at the weekend, all I ever wanted to be regarded was as an artist. But the record label treated her as a one-off hit maker of a manufactured pop guest vocalist that they could reel out when they needed a hit. But they didn't want to invest in her talent as a songwriter and a recording artist. And she had to free herself from the shackles of the major label in order to get her artistic integrity and be allowed to release her album.
What's fascinating, and the second part to the question really, was why was she able to get the release? While I listen to a lot of R&B, soul, funk, jazz, those artists seem to go through hell and still don't get a contractual release. Why was Ray so lucky?
Yeah, the executives at Polydor will be kicking themselves, obviously, having seen her released and then go on to such acclaim and success. And I think one of the reasons why she was able to walk away is she would have been profitable because of those hits that she had, that they hadn't invested in the long-term development of her album release. So to them, if they didn't believe in the music, but they had a positive bank balance from her singles releases, there was no harm to the business in letting her go. Whereas quite often you find that artists who are able to release albums, but something goes wrong and the music doesn't connect, the record label feels that they're in the hole to, you know, and with the big labels comes big budgets. So they've maybe spent £500,000 supporting and launching an act to then find that the music's not connecting. They don't want to see them walk away with the masters that they've invested in unless they can pay their way out. So usually it's a negotiation. Can you afford to buy yourself out of the contract?
It sounds like a hostage negotiation to a certain extent.
Well, we've seen in some of the legal cases, obviously George Michael lost his case against Sony, but was released in the end anyway. But, as they said, the judge said, by all, reasonable methodologies or interpretations, you've become a very wealthy man, Mr. Michael. So it's not like you've lost out. But what George Michael was saying is, I've got to deliver 5 more albums and I don't believe in this company as an artistic partner any longer. So it was to him, to a lot of artists, when they end up in that situation where the relationship breaks down, it does feel like a hostage situation.
A lot of people now with technology and, say, a laptop and an internet connection and Canva in order to do your images or whatever, it's pretty much now you can wake up this morning and get yourself as the young people say, dance floor banger.
Exactly. And a great example of that is the 22-year-old producer Casso, who actually was responsible for one of Ray's nominations for Best Song of the Year. He produced that track on his laptop in his university dorms in Swansea, I believe, and sent it out to industry contacts trying to get someone to cut it, and ended up managing to collaborate with Ray and had a huge dance floor banger as a result.
I knew I'd get my terminology right at some point. So the rise of independent artists now has been remarkable. And obviously that example that you gave is a classic one. And their contributions of independent artists now are totaling $4.5 billion on the Spotify payout. How do you think streaming platforms have changed the landscape for independent musicians?
I think digital technology across the board, like you said, the production has become much more accessible with the laptops and, you know, digital audio workstations like Logic that people can make music on. And the distribution's become a lot easier too. Some might say too easy because 120,000 tracks are released on Spotify every single day. So you can understand why out of that huge wave of music, the power of the major labels is diluting. And Spotify's announcement last week that 4.5 billion, 50% of all the payouts last year for music on the streaming platform were to the independent sector, not to the major labels. That's a huge shift in the market. Traditionally, the majors had about 70 to 75% of the market in the old model of physical distribution or even digital downloads. So now with the accessibility to release your own music via independent labels or even DIY on your own like Ray did, is come to be half the market. And I imagine will only increase, which is a fantastic way to uncouple creativity from that hostage situation we just discussed.
Because what I found fascinating is really for the most part, record companies had it pretty good. They would sign an artist, they would nurture the artist because it was their investment, and they would then be able to then, if they were lucky, reap the rewards from that artist. But there were certain processes that were seen as dodgy. For example, you know, there were certain clauses in contracts like breakages that were held over from the old shellac days of 78.
Yeah.
And obviously, the George Michael situation and the Prince situation is I've paid back all the loan in relation to my record contract, but now you want to keep me here. And it's like basically having a mortgage on a house for our listeners that don't necessarily understand how record companies work. They give you an advance, and that advance basically is to for your record costs and basically to promote you and so on and so forth. And it's effectively a loan. But obviously, once that loan is paid back, a lot of the artists, i.e. Prince and i.e. George Michael, they were saying, hold on, you know, we now should own our work. Because if I bought the wood and I bought the glue and I bought the hammer and the nails and I've made this chair, and once I've sold it, I've sold it, fair enough, that's one thing. But if it's mine, I own it.
Yeah.
And I think that was where the difficulty is. I think the rise of the independents, people see the record companies getting greedy or becoming very greedy or becoming very, very powerful. What do you think to that assumption from artists generally?
Yeah, well, I think if you take the mortgage analogy you gave, imagine if you paid your mortgage down over 25 years and then found out that you didn't actually own the house after all, the bank would still own it. And that's effectively what happens with the master rights with big artists and the major labels, that generally the contracts involve a transfer of ownership in perpetuity for the master rights of the recordings and all the performances that the artist does for the label. And then they're asked to pay for all the costs of recording and often, you know, a huge contribution towards the marketing costs too. And once that's paid down, the record label still owns the master and that they can't escape. And I think that the dynamic has been changed fundamentally by the digital economy. So in the physical economy, record labels could justify that kind of unfair terms. Again, with the excitement and the focus on newness, you would always find that the contracts favor the big labels because they're dealing with a brand new artist who's a little bit naive or badly advised or just doesn't have any negotiating power. And the major labels have all the power, that they have the distribution, they're going to invest the money. So most artists would sign up if, you know, I'm going to help you record your album. I'm going to market you and spend £500,000 launching you. Most artists are like, yeah, that sounds great. But then they realize they're trapped. And in the physical world, there were huge risks of unknown demand, of physical distribution, you know, taking stock out to all the record shops around the nation and around the world. Obviously, that was a big risk industry. Now you distribute music with a click of a button. And there's no risk of unknown demand and no risk of physical distribution. So for labels to still have the same dominating power in a digital era makes no sense. And artists are getting smarter and artists like Ray and others who, you know, you've got rappers like Dave and Stormzy when he first started out, they were able to launch their careers, keeping their rights and building their audience independently.
And that's fascinating to me because Spotify were very proud to put out this $4.5 billion figure. But why do some independent musicians feel shortchanged by streaming services, with some claiming they are literally earning pennies?
Because they're literally earning pennies. There's no mystery any longer. Like I said, in the past, there was this uncertainty, almost an act of magic. You would never know in the physical era, you never knew who your customers were. Obviously, if you were a touring band, you'd meet them when you went and do live shows. But the record companies had no idea who their customers were. In fact, their customers were radio stations and retailers. And as long as they got their music played on the radio and as long as they got their CDs and vinyl stocked in the physical distributors, they didn't need to know who the customers were. Now, you know exactly who your customers are, you know where they are, you know how often they listen, and you know when they listen and why they listen. And the truth is, if they aren't listening enough, you're not going to get paid very much. So the big payouts, huge payouts, are going to the biggest stars, obviously, who are working the system. Acts like Taylor Swift, Lana Del Rey, consistently releasing music. That means that they are always front of mind when people go on the streaming platforms of what to play. They're also boosted by the algorithms of, you know, this is popular, so you're probably going to like it too. And these artists are earning hundreds of millions from streaming. But if you're a new artist and you're getting less than 1,000 plays a year, you know what? Spotify aren't even going to pay you a thing. They're splitting the market now into the professional segment and the amateur segment. And if your tracks get less than 1,000 plays a year, you're considered to be an amateur.
That is a bit soul-destroying, to say the least. But it actually leads into a couple of other questions that I thought of. The first is Berry Gordy of Motown Records, legendary figure in the recording industry, once alleged to have said to an artist, "Do you want to be an artist or do you want to eat?" Now, could you share some insights into how artists can navigate the balance between artistic freedom and commercial success?
Yeah, definitely. And I think maybe the starting point is to, in a way, side with Berry Gordy initially, in that not everyone is an artist. And I think that too often we use the term artist when actually what we mean is performer. And I think with the Ray situation, the record label decided she was a performer, not an artist. And we've seen with her own success and her independent release that she is, in fact, an artist. But I think the difference is that a performer probably doesn't write their own songs, doesn't have a strong creative vision, doesn't really have a soapbox to stand on and a political or kind of artistic, message to deliver. They're happy to take other people's songs, interpret them really well, very professionally perform them and record them. But that's it. They're doing a job. And in Berry Gordy's terms, they're there to eat. Whereas there's other people who are driven by a pure creative urge. They would do it for free. But when they're successful and they could connect with an audience because of their authenticity and because of their artistic vision and values and effort to slow build a career rather than try and break overnight, they can be very successful too. You know, they're not going to go hungry when they are genuinely successful. It was actually a major label president, a partner label to Polydor within the Universal Group, Island Records, again, started out as a very successful, credible independent label set up by Chris Blackwell. But their recent president, Darkest Bees, has a really great analogy, and he may have got it from someone else, but he told it to me, that the combination they need, they're willing to slow cook the food, but they need some stuff popping off in the microwave in the meantime. And if you really kind of cut it down, the independent label is all about that slow cook, that, you know, genuine artistic vision, give them time to develop, don't push for commercial success and see what happens. Whereas the major labels have increasingly become the microwave of music.
Indeed. And that's a very good analogy. But going back to Ray briefly, in 2023, we saw women dominate in the UK charts, with female artists spending 31 weeks at the top. What do you think about this trend, and what role do you see independent artists playing in shaping the music industry's future?
Yeah, I think it's really important, the diversity on all fronts, whether it's gender diversity or ethnic diversity. I think we're seeing a real wave of, you know, challenge and therefore change within the industry, where people are realizing the past is very much belongs in the past. I went to see the musical about Live Aid at the Old Vic at the weekend, just for one day. And it made me research the lineup of the acts that played Live Aid in 1985. And I realized that almost all of them were male and almost all of them were white. And they were the biggest acts in the world. You know, Bob Geldof did an amazing job getting everyone involved. But apparently Stevie Wonder turned down a slot on the Philadelphia stage because he didn't want to be a token black person on the lineup. And that's how the industry was in the 1980s. Now we're seeing that women are dominating, that the music and artists that we see on our stages and on our screens are much more diverse and representative of what's always been the richness of music, the genres of music, almost all of which, you know, can be followed back to the African diaspora. We're finally seeing that recognized in the artists and the success of people front of screen, but also behind the scenes as well.
Talking about crossing genres and basically being successful in other genres that are not necessarily seen as your principal genre, let's talk about Beyoncé. Texas Hold'em and 16 Carriages,
yeah,
as her latest sort of digital double A side single. Initial resistance from the country stations in America, which is much more polarized than we are here in the UK, incredibly polarized over there.
Definitely.
But with the power of the Beehive, I hope I'm pronouncing it properly in this, unless they come after me. a very supportive, in inverted commas, fan base.
Yeah.
She was able to make that transition across to country radio.
Yeah.
And obviously has been the first black female country artist, even though that's not her principal genre, but of all time.
Yeah.
So she's been the one that's broken through. And a lot of black, especially black female country artists have said how that's been very helpful for them. But the fact is they've been plugging away for years and sort of not being taken very seriously. So it's a double-edged sword with these things.
Definitely. Well, I think the American market is still very polarized, as you said, and almost still racially segregated. And it's a real surprise. Obviously, it's not like that. I hope that other people in the UK agree it's not like that here. But in the US, it apparently is still very much treated that way. And, you know, they use euphemisms for white music and black music. So traditionally, country is white music and pop is white music. And obviously, urban is black music. And all credit to Beyoncé. She's been riding the genres recently and really celebrating. I think what she's doing is making a series of statements, social statements. So Renaissance One was all about celebrating the queer and black culture that originated in the New York house and New Detroit house scenes, celebrating those subcultures. And now I think she is purposely ruffling some feathers to say, why is music segregated? Why can't you jump into a traditionally white genre like country as a black artist? So I think all credit to her. I think that Beyoncé is a great example of someone who took the platform and power of a major label career and treated herself as an independent artist and had the credibility to do so. So all of her albums in the last 12, 15 years have all been experimental in nature, provocative, challenging, spiky at times. This actually sounds to me like, you know, the two new tracks sound like two of the actual poppiest Beyoncé tracks I've heard in a long time. So I don't think that, you know, as a music lover, I don't sort of see it as like that is country and you'd only listen to it if you were a country fan. I see it as taking inspiration from country and delivering two great pop songs.
That's an excellent answer. And it's an excellent observation because they are very, very catchy songs, which probably, if they'd have been done as R&B songs, may not have worked as well.
Indeed.
So I'd like to talk more about your work at the London College of Contemporary Music and try and ascertain what advice would you give to aspiring musicians considering their career paths?
Yeah, well, if I just touch on the Ray stuff again, just briefly to make this point, it was really heartening to see the value of music education recognized the Brits, where Ray's former principal, he's still the principal of the Brit School, obviously strongly aligned with the Brit Awards because the Brit School is funded by the Brit Trust. He came on stage to give Ray her award for Album of the Year, and she couldn't quite believe her, you know, that this was happening. But she had clearly valued her grounding in music education from the Brit School. And we saw it last year with the Mercury Music Prize, with the Ezra Collective shouting out the youth groups and music organizations that helped them develop and find their passion and follow their passions in music. So really, it's about the support of young people and their aspirations and giving them the platforms to explore their creativity and bring through a new generation that is willing to challenge the status quo and have the confidence sometimes to break through the boundaries like Ray's done with her escape from the major label system.
Brilliant. So where can our Cashflow Show podcast radio business listeners go to for more information?
Yeah, so if you're interested in getting your grounding in music education, then and we'd love if you would follow your passion like Ray has and learn all about music and the music industry, you should come to our website, lccm.org.uk, or join our social community. Our Instagram handle is at lccmlondon.
Anthony Hamer-Hodges, Principal at the London College of Contemporary Music, thank you for joining us on the Cashflow Show in association with Podcast Radio Business.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You're most welcome.